Welcome to the Live Up Podcast, where we watch the movies from our youth to see if they live up. We will review, discuss, and score the movie in question to see if it lives up to us as adults and whether it would live up to kids today. You could follow us at Live Up Pod on all the socials. Make sure, loyal listeners, to like, subscribe, leave a review. That would be super helpful. I'm Jess Latterman.
And I'm Amanda Treat. Today, we're reviewing a 1986 animated musical that Disney had nothing to do with. Somewhere out there, there's a little mouse named Fievel who can't hit those high notes. It's American Tail!
Oh my god, that's so funny.
I forgot how out of tune those little mice are when they're singing. It's kind of adorable and kind of screechy. It's hilarious.
I was, like, all excited to listen to that song again, and I was like, oh, the kids sing it. Oh no.
Oh, they're butchering it. Oh. Who decided this was okay? So, Jess, you obviously have seen this movie before, but what is your history with An American Tale?
I have a memory of seeing it in the theater, but I feel like 1986 might be too early. But I think I did see it in the theater, or maybe a re-release. I've seen it a handful of times. It wasn't as, like, beloved as other Disney movies in our household, even Disney movies geared towards younger kids, because I think this one is geared towards younger folks. This is a question I actually had as I was watching the movie. The storyline of American Tail being very much following the immigrant experience of Russian Jews in the whatever time period it was. I mean, that's essentially the immigration story of most Jews growing up in the 80s in New York, which is me, by the way, listeners. So I kind of wondered whether this movie was, like, as popular outside of New York, because it's very much like the exact immigration story is, like, pretty much everyone I grew up with, like, or their family.
I think it was popular, though. I mean, the song that came out of this, Somewhere Out There, not sung by the mice, was number two in the country.
Oh, really?
And I think, yeah, this came out that season right after Thanksgiving, where parents are looking for some vacation week things to do with their kids. So it hit that sweet spot for, oh my god, take the kids to the movies and get them out of the house.
Yeah,
which is probably why both of us saw this in the theater. But no, I think this was a pretty big hit across the country, not just with descendants of Russian Jews.
I watched it with my son, who's seven. I did not watch it with Lily. She had a friend over at the time, and I felt like probably not one she'll really want to watch anyway, but that's fine.
Yeah, this does feel targeted to your
son. Same age as Fievel.
Your daughter's age group.
Well, what? So you saw it in the theater too. What's your history with it?
I did, and I remember it was definitely the Christmas season, and in hindsight, I think my mom made my dad take me and my sister Emily to go see this to get us out of the house so she could wrap Christmas presents without us seeing what we were getting. I remember we went on a school night, which was really, really unusual, and it was specifically in this movie theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, which now has a beautiful shopping mall around it and a megaplex, and it's, like, a big to-do to go there, but at the time, it was, like, this abandoned parking lot, creepy, empty, and, like, the movie theater, nobody was in there, and
you
it felt abandoned.
Such a detailed
but we went into this
of watching this.
I do, because it was just weird. It was weird to be watching a movie on a school night, and it was weird that nobody else was there. So it was just my dad and my sister and me. But I remember we liked the movie, even though there were scenes like the ocean storm scene or, like, anytime the cats came gunning for Fievel. That seemed scary. I would have also been 7 years old, like your son, and I'm a year older than you.
Six,
so you would have been six if you saw this in the theater. But then I have several younger siblings, so we ended up having this on VHS cassette.
I feel like we must have owned it as well, because I definitely saw it multiple times.
Yeah, I feel like I saw this dozens of times.
But it wasn't on TV.
No. Yeah, there wasn't a channel that was playing this regularly, and it wasn't a Disney movie, so it wasn't on the Disney channel. I definitely haven't seen this in 35 years or more, and I still felt all of the songs were very familiar. You know, as they started singing, it was like, oh, I remember this one. Yeah, okay. Not as good as I remembered, but
definitely not.
Okay.
Not exactly a Howard Ashman masterpiece, but...
No, it wasn't.
Okay.
What's kind of funny, though, is Disney released a non-musical movie, Basil the Great Mouse Detective.
Never heard of that.
4 months before this, I saw that. It was freaking weird and not good. But maybe we have to, like, cover that because I could be totally wrong. Maybe it was amazing.
So there were two mouse movies out at the same time?
Yes, two mice movies with them having their own little culture going on in the background of our culture and us just not That's noticing weird. The mice doing their own detective work or solving their own crimes or fighting the cats. Like, okay. These two mice movies could have existed at the same time frame, too. You know, like Fievel and Basil might be in the, you know, passing each other on the street sort of thing. This movie totally smoked the really? Disney movie. Like, the Disney movie was really bad at the box office, and people didn't like it. And this movie, people didn't love it. Like, Siskel and Ebert gave this two thumbs down, but which we won't let influence our rating later. But, yeah, this was just the way more popular of the two nearly identical world-building mice movies that came out within 4 months of each other in 1986.
It's a very specific kind of world-building. And I was not aware that there was also, like, two mouse movies.
I think, you know how it's kind of like two volcano movies came out at the same time and two comets are about to strike the Earth and kill us all.
It's like, does one writer get pissed at the other writer and then they end up, like, writing two different things that end up getting released?
Yeah, or they're racing to release their movie first to be like, we're the first one, we're the original, don't sue us for copyright infringement.
I don't know.
So anyway, for this mouse movie, Jess, would you like to give a plot summary of American Tail?
I will try, although this one's pretty simple. So this one is basically ragtime meets the classic American immigration story. Because we have to have a little class warfare in our Live Up Pod reviews of movies. Somewhere in here, a little mouse gets lost and we're then meant to believe cats are bigots who must be sent to China to save the idea of America.
I wrote over your notes. Did you see that?
Oh, what did you say?
So Hong Kong, where they end up going, is actually a British colony, and they're being sent there. So I think it's just the far ends of the earth.
Oh, it's a boat to Hong Kong.
The cats are going to have to learn to speak Chinese. It's a boat to Hong Kong, and they're going to the British Hong Kong.
So thank you for that history lesson, Amanda. Did not catch that. And I've been to Hong Kong. It's like I've been to Hong Kong and China, and I didn't get to.
But now it's part of China again, as of 1997.
I should have known that. Yeah, I did not. I've been corrected, and I'm just going to leave all this in. I'm not going to edit it out.
Yeah. Well, no, this is a great segue to some comments I wrote for myself, was that this movie has a lot of date prompts and location prompts. You know, it starts with 1885, Shostka, Russia.
I just want to stop right there, because for younger kids, even though they could read, right, like my son could read, but date prompts and things like anything that other than once upon a time for text on screen is kind of like, why are you doing that for a movie geared towards little kids?
Exactly what I was thinking, and then realized that this movie about little animated mice was making me feel like I flunked history class in high school, because I'm assuming they picked this location in this time for a very specific reason, and I have no idea what it was other than, yes, there are pogroms going on in Russia. I'm loosely aware of that. But this first scene, the village gets attacked and someone in the background's yelling, Cossacks! And I'm immediately Googling, like, oh my God, what were the Cossacks again? Like, I don't remember. I don't. We didn't learn this in history class. So that's a very specific setting that they've chosen. And then they go out of the port of Hamburg and we get, you know, 1885 Hamburg. And off go the boats to the U.S., they get to New York and there's references to Tammany Hall, which I do remember, but couldn't remember what it was. So I had to Google that. And like, man, these mice are schooling me on U.S. and world history. Yeah. So this movie, it's got all this specific detail in there and it's making you Google what the heck they're talking about. The adults, like the kids, I remember as a kid, I wasn't even reading the captions.
But I think this is where I was also questioning this now watching as an adult, because I explained this to my son too. Again, this is the timeline of a lot, maybe just me, but a lot of, let's say, third generation immigrants, right? If they're coming from Eastern Europe or Russia, between these years and they're Jewish. This is their thing. New York City is full of them and the New York area. Not that I like know that much about my own family history. That's not what this podcast is about. But that vague kind of tie to that, I think as a kid, I just assumed was everybody's tie to their own kind of story of America. But not really. That's really very specific. And even things like Tammany Hall, I know what that is because I grew up in the New York area. So there's some things that are really specific for New York.
And really specific to 1885. Yeah. These are historic events happening those years.
And maybe that through like the early 20s. Yeah, this is not meant to be a history lesson, people. But I think that even as a six-year-old, maybe, or even rewatching it, I just assumed as a kid that this was everybody's story and everybody can connect to it in that way. But I guess not. And then even watching again, my son, he has no clue. No clue. I had to explain everything.
Well, so this is a movie produced by Steven Spielberg, who then made Fievel's the mascot of Amblin Entertainment until that company was dissolved, but that's Steven Spielberg's production company. Steven Spielberg's grandfather was named Fievel, and that's where the name came from. Yeah, everybody pretty much had a sob story from somewhere. Like, my family came from Ireland. It's like, oh, those damn English, they starved us, and you know.
If Spielberg were Irish, this could have just would have switched around to be from Ireland.
Would have been the English cats chasing the Irish mice.
Escaping the potato famine.
Onto a boat. And exactly. Yeah. Oh, those poor little mice without their potatoes. It does feel indulgent, but I think this could have applied to so many different immigrant stories. So it's kind of nice that they're specific about one, but it did make me feel like I needed to research all the history of what is going on in this movie. Because, as we said, these mice are experiencing their own little mice culture. You know, it starts with a shot of the Moskowitz family, like the human family. But as you zoom in on their house, you see a little door on the side with another little sign, the Moskowitz family. And there's just like a parallel of everything that the humans are doing going on in the mice world. So like when they immigrate, you get to Castle Garden, which was before Ellis Island, and then there's a little smaller mouse garden immigration center where they're stamping all the mice through and changing their names to be more American mouse. It's kind of fun that there's this parallel society going on with the mice, but at the same time, whatever's going on in the background with the humans is like a rated R movie. Like, there is something so violent and awful going on in the background of the mice. The mice are adorable. The humans are getting massacred. Like, it's something so scary, and like, we never focus on what the humans are doing.
Kids don't notice that. Like, certainly my son did not notice that, and I'm sure you and I did not notice that as kids. But I noticed it as an adult, even when they're back in what I'm going to call the Russian shtetl. The first shot is actually humans on horseback going in, basically sacking the town.
And yelling, Cossacks! Like, oh no, the Cossacks.
Yeah, as an adult, you understand what's going on and what they need to escape from. But then it's cats chasing the mice it switches to. I don't think as a kid I even registered the switch and the parallels. And certainly Isaac didn't. It actually reads as much darker to a current, to an adult now watching it than to a kid. Yeah. It's pretty dark. I mean, I was even like, oh, is this going to be a bit much, this movie? Like, what is this?
Yeah. So I didn't find a lot of fun facts on this movie. There was not a lot of trivia out there.
Not a lot of face melts
that
happened.
But
no.
One thing, no.
Sadly.
No, not enough face melts. Or actually, that was in the rated R human movie above the surface of the mouse world. So this movie originally was scripted to be a whole animal world that was a metaphor for immigration. Oh, so there weren't humans in it at all. And it was like the Disney Robin Hood where different animals were interacting with each other. And I think it was The Rescuers, the Disney movie The Rescuers, where the mice kind of live in their own world separate from the humans, that they made Spielberg go watch that and said, hey, we actually want to keep the humans in this and have the mice kind of mirroring their culture.
I thought that was kind of cute.
Portray it that way. And I like it a lot more that way because it's very funny. You know, they have a bunch of human props, essentially, that, you know, if they're making a speech, they're standing on like a can of hairspray or something for the humans, and that you see them taking teacups and taking baths in them. And it's kind of cute how they're repurposing all our props. Kind of like, it's like the little mermaid and her dingle hopper and there. Dingy, you know, like,
yeah. Pretty much.
Yeah, no, it's kind of fun to think that there's this other world that exists below the surface when we're not paying attention, that the mice are doing all sorts of creative things without our knowledge, although it makes me feel terrible about the mice that were living in my basement last winter that we had to get rid of. But they might have had a whole singing musical going on down there, and
you were the bad guys. Absolutely. Oh. Yeah.
What did we do? So I did like that fact that they changed the script specifically to bring the humans back in and make it less of an animal metaphor and more of that the mice are paralleling the experience that the humans, the poor humans in their rated R Schindler's List movie that's going on beyond them.
Yeah.
I don't want to see the human version of this. I don't. It's freaking dark.
I mean, I think it kind of exists in Ragtime, but with songs. Or is this Ragtime musical? Yeah, that element did make it dark for me. But I did like the different world. It still resonates with kids. I think Isaac liked it. It actually made him understand it a little bit better, that it mirrored kind of the human world.
Well, since I had Wikipedia up the entire time I was watching this to try to stay on top of where are we now and what's happening here, the part of the world that the Mouskowitz family comes from is actually Ukraine.
Oh, there was actually that specific.
They're Ukrainian Jewish mice.
Oh.
It's a town in Ukraine.
Oh, it's actually a real town?
This is a story.
Oh.
It's a real town. Yep. Shostka.
I thought they just made something like vaguely sound like shtetl, and that made me laugh.
No, they went for a real historic place that apparently was attacked by Cossacks. Like, again, the human version of this is a sequel to Schindler's
prequel,
List.
Prequel,
or a prequel to Schindler's List. Not fun to watch. The singing in that is not good either. It's dark human movie. But anyway, let's talk about the characters, those cute little adorable mice. Starting with our hero, Fievel Mouskowitz, age 7. He's different than I remembered.
It's a little bit more annoying than I remembered.
Kid me, I remember thinking Fievel was really brave and curious, and adult me is like, whoa, this kid is out of control. Somebody needs to keep an eye on this kid, because he just keeps drifting off and getting into so much trouble. Like, he doesn't just screw up. He screws up in a way, like, one scene he floats off on a bar of soap when they're in the ship. And it immediately crashes into a straight razor that's about to decapitate him. Like, it's not just a little. Like, Fievel nearly gets killed in every single scene where he's on his own. And doesn't think twice about it. It's just yelling and like, ah, now I'm being swallowed by a cat. And, ah, now I'm being crushed by this, like, horse's hoof. Like, he nearly gets killed in every scene. It's insane.
Yeah.
I don't know. Somebody's got to just put a leash on this kid.
Yeah, he doesn't have the modern day thing that's like a backpack / leash for the parents to hang on to.
Papa and Mama Mouskowitz, get a leash. Oh, you keep losing this kid. No wonder they thought he was dead. He nearly dies.
So many times.
So many times.
9 lives of a mouse? He, I think, is pretty much a typical hero for a kid to relate to. He's precocious. He's kind of cute. I find him a little saccharine and annoying as an adult, but I think kids don't really read it that way. And I don't think my son read it that way either.
Yeah.
You know, he's in oversized clothes, so he's meant to, like, look cute. He's curious. He's asking these questions. He's asking some funny questions like, why are we walking? What are we doing? Are we there yet? It's kind of typical kid stuff.
He literally says, are we there yet, on a boat journey from Hamburg
to New York.
That probably took 3.5 months, and he is sitting there going, are we there yet? Like, oh,
he also, he can't sing for shit. Cannot sing.
No.
For some reason, they cast someone to sing a song that's a good song.
An actual 6-year-old. They got an actual 6-year-old.
No offense to that 6-year-old who's now probably, like, you know, in their 50s or whatever. You can't sing. Couldn't sing. And for some reason, that was okay with the producers. Yeah. Really out of tune. It was a little painful to listen to.
I bet that, so, like, he was 6 years old when he recorded this. He's basically our age.
Oh, yeah.
But I bet he went to college and people would, like, pump him full of alcohol and be like, all right, now sing Somewhere Out There. And you got to do it in the Little Mouse voice. Go.
You know that happened.
He was the entertainment at all the frat parties. Yeah. He does a keg stand and then sings Somewhere Out There and then passes out on the floor. Like, Five Little keeps passing out.
Yeah, so
like,
it's the same thing. I couldn't get past his crappy singing voice. It was like going to a pre-K glee club. It was not great.
Oh, yeah. It's like going to a children's recital.
Yeah, but like
recital.
A young children's recital. But I guess like then they're cute. But I didn't think he was that cute. I was sort of shocked because like as an adult, you have a nostalgia for this song. You know the Somewhere Out There song. It is a great song. And then I'm like, oh, yay, it's going to happen.
Song.
It's going to start singing. And like, here it comes.
Here it
and
comes.
I was like, what? Eyes wide, cringe emoji face.
That kid hits the high note on the word pale, and you just feel a shudder in your spine. Like, oh, he's breaking the glass in the house. Oh, my God. Five'll stop.
Oh, I know my wife did not watch it with us, but she was like, oh, how is it? And I was just like, well, let me just give you a sense. And I sang, I tried to sing. I was like, somewhere out there. And she was like, what? I was like, that's what it sounded like. She's like, no.
Yeah. We're all thinking of Linda Ronstadt's beautiful version of this. That's not what's in the movie. That's what's in the end credits. That's the Celine Dion version of it. Like,
I thought that was the version in the movie. I was like, oh, that's not what I remember.
No,
yeah, that's not great.
So some other things about Five'll that I didn't remember at all, but he wants to see fish when they're on the boat. So he goes up on the deck during a storm, stupidly, falls overboard. Manages to float his way to New York City in a bottle. Like, all right, you know, good for him, because we wouldn't have had much of a movie otherwise. So he gets there and is pulled up on the Statue of Liberty Island by a pigeon who is played, of all people, it's a French accent being put on by Christopher Plummer.
You know, his voice sounded familiar, and I went and looked it up as I was watching. I'm like, Christopher Plummer? What?
Not to say that Disney keeps stealing ideas from all these other movies we're watching, but is this where Lumiere comes from?
My God.
Where they're like, let's go get an American star, stick a French accent on him, and make him sing. Yes. Maybe. We love the idea of the drunken Disney screenwriters coming up with random ideas while they're watching these other movies we're reviewing. So here's another one.
And for listeners, this is in previous episodes where Disney plots for later movies show up in older movies. And you're like, wait a minute.
Hey, Disney writers.
So, I think you're onto something.
You had a Sunday fun day and you watched these movies and then you handed the script into Disney with the same exact plot.
Like, nobody noticed their
characters. But when Five'll arrives and is hanging out with Henri the Pigeon, voiced by Christopher Plummer, he immediately, even though he is miraculously floated in a bottle to exactly where his parents are, he is immediately giving up on finding them. Just like, I'm never gonna find them! And they do a whole song about it. But as they go through the movie, Five'll has all these successes, and then anytime he's left on his own, he's just like, I'm never gonna find them! And he just keeps giving up, like, at a moment's notice, even though everything seems to be going in the right direction for him. It's super weird. So I found that really unlikable about him.
I think having a 7-year-old boy myself, I feel like this is very on brand. But from a movie standpoint, he's not exactly, like, that much of a hero you're going to attach to. And I'm not even thinking of this as an adult now, but even as a kid, it's like, well, he's sort of just whiny.
Yeah.
But that being said, I think kids don't think that deeply about it. And they're just like, yeah, he saves the day. Cool.
We're being old curmudgeons.
Get off
my lawn with your whiny attitude, Five'll. One thing I will say about him, and I think this is supposed to be his super skill, but it's shown at the beginning that his papa tells the kids stories. So they do Rapunzel. They do apparently The Great Mouse of Mintz. And Five'll is able to take these stories he heard and turn them into, like, actionable escape plans at certain points. And that's pretty creative, that in his head he thinks, oh, Rapunzel put her hair out the window. We're going to throw a bunch of cloth out the window and use it as a ladder. Or he helps orchestrate the mice all getting together and building this giant mouse that is fire-breathing and we're going to chase the cats off the pier. And for some reason, the adults all seem to go with it. Anytime he suggests one of these crazy things, So that's his super skill, is that he can turn some fantasy into a plausible, actionable project management.
Says plan. Amanda, the order so, Muppet.
Good job.
He's a future final. Project manager.
Oh, yes. Yes. I appreciate his work breakdown structures of turning a story about a giant mouse into a project.
And that is successful in getting the cats to our boat to Hong Kong, not to China yet.
Well, we should talk about the rest of the Mouskowitz mm-hmm. family. We're just going to lump them all together. We have Papa, we have Mama, we have Tanya, and we have Sasha, the baby mouse who doesn't do anything and disappears.
Halfway through the movie, I'm like, what happened to the baby? The baby's gone.
Totally wrote notes down about that. Like, where is the baby?
Just
they just got a... Is there a mouse babysitting club that also is
See, I
there?
Went darker. I was like, well, first went Fievel, then went the baby. Because, like, the baby just,
no.
you know, just... This is such a small detail, but the mom is always cradling this infant. And then halfway through the movie, the mom's like running around. The infant is nowhere to be seen. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Disappears.
The baby disappears and is never mentioned again. So,
sorry
Sasha. So, we've got this family dynamic where the papa is just super jolly. He's telling the kids fun stories. He's the one giving the Hanukkah presents, where the mom is kind of the curmudgeon buzzkill on the other side of the room. But, like, she obviously got those presents for the kids, and dad's taking all the credit here. I know so many people get ticked off around the holidays when the dad gives the gift that he doesn't even know it's in the box. And then it's like, here you go! And it's like, oh my god, thank you! And it's like, your mom did all the work. She seems a little spent, probably from years of that kind of behavior where Papa's just the fun one and she's the buzzkill. It was a very Berenstain Bear vibe to me. Like, do you remember reading those books where Mama was always the buzzkill
in her apron in the kitchen? However, I will just say one thing for Berenstain Bears, because I remember that about it. And when my son was really young, like in pre-K, he got out a bunch of Berenstain Bears books from the library. And I was like, oh, Jesus. So reading some of the older ones are awful like that. The mom is always just like that. She's just in the background. She's a curmudgeon. The dad's the fun one.
She's the one saying no. Dad's like, you can totally play with dynamite.
Exactly. But the newer books sort of reverse it, where the dad is sort of dopey but fun, and the mom just completely kicks ass and takes names. So they sort of equalize it. So I just want to give that little redemption to Berenstain Bears.
I feel like the dad was always
dopey.
Like, he was the Homer Simpson.
He's kind of an idiot.
Papa Mouskowitz is totally the Homer Simpson here.
Also, we need to talk about how the mom and the dad are portrayed as, like, 50-year-olds. I mean, they have gray hair. They're pudgy with gray hair. And I'm like, even in animation, they're making parents look ancient.
I did not catch the name of the voice actor who plays Papa Mouskowitz, but apparently he played Barbara Streisand's father in Gentle. So he was of a certain age.
But they even draw them that way.
Yeah, they've lived a life in this Ukrainian village.
Yeah, the dad was sort of like, I found him to be kind of annoying, actually, as an adult. I don't know if as a kid I remembered much about him, but he's just such a dumb optimist that maybe I'm just like so jaded as a middle-aged person. You know, he's singing, like, cats. He has this whole thing of, like, there's no cats in America. And the storyline that, you know, the cats are, you know, sort of drove them out through the pogroms of Ukraine. And now they've immigrated to the United States because instead of the streets are lined with gold kind of thing, city on a hill, it's there's no cats in America. And the dad is, like, a real believer in this. It's encapsulated in a song on the boat. So everybody's, like, sad sack. They're in rags and, you know, the ship's, like, in a storm. And
they've been on the boat for three months and they're, like, vomiting. You've got
and the dad's in the corner with, like, starting to sing, there's no cats in America. And in each verse of the song, someone else on the boat is, like, telling their sob story in the piece of the song they have. So
and they keep changing the music style to a stereotype or a stereotypical music in each of those countries. So you go to the Italian guy and it's like
practically raining meatballs.
Okay, now that mouse fought some cats in Italy with meatballs, and then we're going to Ireland and, like, you know, sad Irish, they cut off our heads and, like, those stupid English cats and They ate everything but her tail, and oh, we're Catholic. Those little Catholic Irish
mice. That's what gets me is the Irish one, when he's like, the cat ate everything but her tail, and he's telling the story, and he's like laying on the grave of his great love who got eaten by a cat, and then it's a hard cut to the dad going, there's no cats in America!
But there's no cats!
It actually made me laugh out loud, because I was like, this is kind of funny.
It is... Yeah, this music in the entire movie is ridiculous, but this song really is ridiculous. And I just, at a certain point, was like, you know what, just go with it. Like, great, they think there's no cats in America. It hit a cringe point, and then I just moved past it, and it was just so silly that I was like, yeah, fine. You can have it.
It doesn't resonate as cringe for kids. I think it, but I don't think the song is good enough to resonate as much of anything. I mean... No. It's not just in these days, in the age of Encanto, where you have like an absolute masterpiece soundtrack. Even when we grew up, you have, you know, songs about Stockholm Syndrome with Beauty and the Beast, but you forgive that because the music is so good.
And the music's beautiful, and so yeah.
I found the songs to be a little painful to sit through.
There's also some like bad violin music going on.
Every time the violin plays, I just want to start Sunrise, Sunset comes into my head.
It does, yeah.
For listeners who are not musical people, that is from Fiddler on the Roof, and it is a great masterpiece of a soundtrack, but that is not this movie. But it would have been nice if it was in it.
No. I mean, Papa would have been great in Fiddler on the Roof. He does seem like he fell out of
the little boy I carried, but nope. But that's what kept going into my head, because I was like, oh God, there's better versions of this stuff.
Yeah. If he were a rich man,
he'd be a cat, and he'd be sent to Hong Kong.
There's one other member of the nuclear Mouskowitz family that we should talk about. This is Tanya, the older sister, who seems to be the one with the common sense in the family and is the only one who's like, hey, you think we should look
for
fun?
And they're like, no, he's dead. Get over it. I mean, that's essentially what the mom says.
No, he's definitely dead. Yeah. Don't do it. They land in a neighborhood where they are literally about a cubic foot away from Fievel in all of the scenes in this movie, and just don't sniff him out. I don't know. Don't mice have a sense of smell or something? He escapes out the window Rapunzel style and goes past their window on his way to the ground to run off and go look for them. Like, you literally just crossed each other within inches.
That's something that's kind of fun for kids, though. Isaac kind of liked seeing that, because it also reminds kids that, oh, they're in the same city. I mean, sometimes you just have to reinforce that plot for younger kids.
That's true. They work so close, and Tanya, the older sister, is absolutely right, as older sisters are absolutely right about everything.
As a fellow older sister.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Younger brothers doing dumb shit.
Yeah. Older sisters hold the world together.
Very true. Never ignore what they're saying.
In Somewhere Out There, Fievel is so bad at singing, he does make Tanya sound like a reasonable singer. She's not good, but she's not as bad as Fievel.
That is true. She's not as bad. And if folks don't remember, it's sort of like a duet under the same sky, if you will.
Yeah, they're both howling at the moon together.
That's why I got like essence of pre-K Glee Club in here. So it's just oof, oof.
All right, so that is the Mouskowitz family. We hope they're reunited by the end of this. We got to go through a bunch of other characters to get to that. Some of them are helpers. Some of them are not. Starting with Warren T. Ratt.
He is really a cat.
He is.
Spoiler alert, sorry.
Yeah, no, he is a slime ball who's just in it for the money. He's extorting all the mice by supposedly using his position as a rat to negotiate with the cats. Except he is a cat.
I actually thought the portrayal it's exactly as Amanda just described. He's basically exploiting the migrants coming in off the boat. And it's a little dark. As a modern day viewing, and I'm sure a modern day viewing, even in the viewing in the 80s, it's really dark. Kids don't pick up on that stuff, though. They don't care.
So, thinking about the size of all these animals, how small is this cat that he's passing as a rat? Like, is he the runt of his litter? Does he have a Napoleon complex? Like, what is happening here that everyone's like, oh, yeah, no, it seems like a rat to me.
He's like the Danny DeVito of rats.
That would have been a lot more...
It would have been more endearing. I regretted saying it as soon as I said it. But it does make it a fun reveal for kids when the rat is revealed to be a cat. But at the same time, it has no... Who cares that he was a rat or a cat? Either way, he's essentially the villain of the story. But it's pretty vague. And You know, it still lands. Like, my son, even today, was like, I really liked it when the rat became, you know, you realize he was the cat. It kind of resonated with him that it was a fun reveal. But for adults watching, it's not some big dramatic. It's not a Luke, I'm your father moment.
And it's kind of a funny character. He's walking around. He's got a cockroach for an accountant that he keeps in his pocket. And I mean, they're just bickering with each other the whole time. And that's kind of silly. He doesn't seem like the baddest bad guy compared to the cats until you get the reveal that he is a cat. And then suddenly he's like extra bad. Yeah. Let's light everyone on fire.
He goes there. Wow,
that just went up to 11 quickly.
That is right. Like, he does go from like, I'm just trying to get by.
I'm just here to negotiate with you too.
Yeah, oh, it goes from that to, you know, murder really quickly.
It does. So yeah, Fievel crosses his path. He sells Fievel to a sweatshop. Fievel promptly escapes with his Rapunzel story. And you don't really circle back on that, but he left dozens of people in that sweatshop. Or maybe they all followed his lead. Tony, the other mouse, the Italian mouse.
Who I totally forgot existed until watching as an adult.
He doesn't do a lot. He's supposed to be a helper character, and he doesn't help.
He talks like this. Really.
Yeah, he's super New York stereotype of Italian New Yorker.
He's sort of like an Artful Dodger character, but not nearly as literary.
He is, yeah.
Little Oliver Twist in here.
Yeah, he knows how to get cheese out of mouse traps without getting caught, and he's just kind of got some streetwise, but he really, best thing he does for Fievel is he falls in love with Bridget and, like, distracts them from what they're meant to be doing, but Bridget's the one who's actually got her shit together.
She's another mouse, just so...
Wait, we need to call out... Yeah, so like Bridget the Irish mouse, who's adorable, is the one who's got the Sigourney Weaver like apartment in New York City that's completely impractical. She takes the two of them to her place, and she lives up in the water tower with the view, and it's like the perfect mouse hangout. Like, there's absolutely no threats of any humans or cats or anything. I
mean, this is a Williamsburg loft worth millions of dollars.
So yeah. Bridget's the best thing that Tony brought into Fievel's world. Like, Bridget's got it all together.
This is where you have a little bit of the class warfare, because she's, you know, we have to fight for our rights and get those cats.
She's a nothing character, but she's in there as, she seems to be a metaphor for, like, a suffragette.
Absolutely.
You know, she's up making speeches, we've all got to come together, we need to fight for our rights, and she does know some of the people, well, she knows some of the mice that have some authority or some leverage, and she's able to take the two of them there to try to help Fievel find his family. So we end up at Tammany Hall.
With Honest John.
Where we get Honest John, who's just the drunkest of the drunk
politician. Like, a little bit of an Irish stereotype, like... Completely leaning in on that. And corrupt.
But then in Waltz is, I think, my favorite character, and I hope you agree with me on this. We have Gussie, the very rich upper, I forget where she lives.
Probably Upper West Side, Upper East Side.
Super, super rich German immigrant mouse who can't pronounce any characters. And I, as a kid, could not understand a single word she was saying. So it was fun to rewatch this and be like, oh, just her accent's so terrible. And it's like part of the joke. This is Madeline Kahn, her third appearance on this podcast. And we love some Madeline Kahn. Yeah, because she was in the Muppet movie.
That's what she was in.
Clue. All and here she is again.
We always love her.
She is bringing the passive-aggressive class warfare into this. Like, she keeps calling out, like, nobody's richer than me, so, and just being a really snob, but she's the lady who gets shit done, and she's the one that Bridget brings Fievel to, like, we gotta help this kid, and she's like, yes, and this kid has a really weird idea about, let's make a giant-ass mouse and scare all the cats. Yeah, that sounds legit, I'm gonna put all my efforts behind this. It's just like, why? You're letting a 7-year-old come up with your war plans.
Okay.
She gets shit done. Good for her. She just can't say the word rally. She
wowie.
Says wowie.
I know. That's right, she does. This is where it's fun for adults, because she is funny. I laughed at her mispronunciation. I recognized that it was Madeline Kahn. That part's fun. I didn't remember her actually at all from when I was a kid. So once I heard her voice come on screen, I was like, oh my God, that's Madeline Kahn. Didn't resonate at all with my son. Not that he disliked it, but he just didn't get it. And also just the whole class warfare story, honestly, I found confusing even as an adult. And I think it completely went over the head of my son and me as a kid. Maybe we're dumb. I don't know. They're very anti-cat. And this is where I get confused with like the laws of the animal kingdom. Like cats are predators. So it's like, are the cats just rich assholes? Are they the predator? It's very confusing because you can't really, if you get rid of them in New York, you don't, you know, cats are everywhere. It wasn't as clear cut. Whereas just the idea of cats or the bad guy even was enough for kids. But the whole class warfare situation, ragtime situation, just like made it confusing to me.
I took it as the cats, they're not necessarily wealthy. They're like thugs or they're like mafia.
Yeah, I guess they have like the sharp claws.
You know, that they're bringing the violence in and they're bringing the muscle in. And it's, oh, what are you drinking that's covered in cats? Sorry, Jessica just held up her beer bottle and I don't know what kind of cat lady beer you're drinking.
Someone who used to work for me got me this.
I thought that
it's a beer koozie that just has cat faces all over it. And I thought it was appropriate. I know this makes me feel like, yeah, I'm pro cat. They're going to go eat Fievel. I'm not really like that, but I thought it would be fun to have a theme.
I was secretly hoping, since you've dressed as characters in the past, that you would show up in an oversized red jacket with a giant floppy blue hat. That would have made it for me, but that's a hard
another
look.
Another time, folks. I'll post a picture on the Instagram of my cat beer koozie.
Your cat koozie could be a great segue to another character we want to talk about, who is Tiger, played by Dom DeLuise, who's in there to make the not all cats argument for this movie.
They're not all bad guys.
They're mostly bad guys, though, but just one of them is not. So he's like a vegetarian cat, and it's Dom DeLuise, who's funny, who stars with Madeline Kahn on like all of those Mel Brooks movies. He comes in way too late in this movie. He's barely in it.
No, you had mentioned how the Gussie's your favorite character. I kind of love the Dom DeLuise Tiger character. You know, he's silly, but this movie is missing a little bit of charm, and he brings the charm.
So I was hoping you were going to say this, but since you haven't volunteered it, I'm asking you, is he a metaphor for a gay character in this movie?
You know how I like to pick up on secret gays.
He's hanging out with all these thugs, but then he expresses that he really likes things like butterflies and ice cream, and that Fievel's like, oh, me too. And like, I think they're trying very hard not to make it anything romantic or sexual at all, even though I thought the song was probably originally written that way. But yeah, he just seems like he's not the masculine cat that the rest of the thugs in the cat clubhouse are supposed to be portraying. And
oh my God, you know that I love to pick up on the gay characters. And this goes all the way back to our Rudolph episode with the very gay storyline.
Dentist.
Wannabe dentist, euphemism for gay. And then you have Mick from Pee Wee Herman. You just generally have Jodie Foster's character, anything she plays, where assumed that Clarice Sterling was a secret gay. You know I love to pick up on it, and I did not pick up on this. This lesbian just fell.
I mean, Tiger's wearing a very tiny little crop top.
He's definitely wearing a crop top.
Is that?
I think that my gaydar is passed to you in this episode. I don't
know.
How
did that happen?
I went with my Long Island Jew, not my les situation, so.
They don't work at the same time.
He does wear a tight little crop top. it's a little lispy.
He does wear a little tiny little crop top.
Yeah, I think we could say he doesn't fit in with the thug cats. I think you're onto something here, Amanda. I like it.
If nothing else, he could be hanging out with Rudolph and the dentist and going on adventures in the Arctic. I felt like he didn't show up until the last 20 minutes of the movie, maybe something. It felt like he came in really late. So at that point, I was like, who is this character? I'm glad he's helping, but who is this character?
It wasn't enough time for kids to get attached to him. Although my son remembered him. And he kind of thought it was fun that, you know, a villain switched sides.
I did like, much like the Robin Hood movie, this is only 80 minutes long.
Merciful.
And I very much appreciate that. It's so merciful to the adults when you only have to sit through 80 minutes rather than 2 hours.
We're jumping in here to other things, but I found that, yes, brevity was a point in this movie's favor. Robin Hood, which we've done, which, by the way, listeners, Robin Hood is one of my favorite episodes, but we've done two Robin Hood episodes, one of them being the original Disney one. It just has, like, it exudes a charm in a short period of time.
Yes.
Generally, we're transitioning to more just outside of the characters and just more general random thoughts. But yeah, if you had Gussie / Madeline Kahn and Dom DeLuise playing Tiger, if you really had more of those characters in here, I think you would have had more of those funny moments. They should have interacted more. And it would have been funny for adults watching as well. And, you know, Isaac didn't really pick up on any of the humor. My son didn't pick up on any of the humor from Madeline Kahn, but he certainly did for Tom. So I think you could have, I mean, for the Tiger, Tom. I was like going with the Tom and Jerry thing. You could have played that up more and it could have been a little bit more entertaining in the brief 80 minutes than it was.
Yeah, no, they're definitely the two strongest characters in this.
Yeah, and you were saying, like, it goes from nice to chaotic in just a few minutes. But the chaos wasn't... There's something fun about the slapstick. Like, there's... And even in our Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the whole first scene of the cartoon baby pretty much almost killing itself is very slapstick and might seem dumb to adults, but really funny for kids. Lady Cluck in Robin Hood... kicking ass.
Oh, and she's, you know, amazing. Yeah.
Somebody always gets shot in the butt with an arrow. There's those funny things that happen in a slapstick way, and I think that this one was just more chaos as opposed to funny slapstick.
No, I agree with you. So we've transitioned to the part of the show where we talk about what's not working for us. I hope we
have. I think we have.
We're letting it fly. So another thing, they need to defeat the cats, and that's the goal of the movie, and they reveal that the rat is a cat, and he tries to light them all on fire,
dark,
which
really
is very dark.
Fast.
And then they chase all the cats off the pier onto this boat that's headed to Hong Kong, and it feels like the movie's over, because we've defeated the bad guys, and all we need to do now is reunite Fievel with his family and... everything's done, and it should happen because they've always been about a cubic foot away from each other. So
right there.
It's right there. But instead, there's this very random scene where Fievel drifts out of the building that they've kind of set on fire and winds up in this orphan alley. And A,
it's like the movie should be over.
It
at this
felt
point,
like the movie
yeah,
was.
It keeps...
the movie should be over. Yeah, like we're just at an end. End over end over end till, you know, Return of the King kind of endings here. Like, why are we still doing this? So he disappears into Orphan Alley, runs into these orphan mice who completely convince him that he's never going to find his family. And it's just bleak
really
and dark.
Bleak.
And
I didn't like that. In this point, my son, who was into the movie and even the next day, talked about it. Like, he clearly kind of liked it. He even specifically told me today, what was the mouse movie? I like the mouse movie. Like, he liked it. However, this is the point exactly in the movie where essentially it was over for him. Because as you just described, they defeat the cats and then there's this whole other thing where he's in Orphan Alley at some point and it's really bleak. And my son basically got up and started, walked to the kitchen, got a snack, went down into the basement to shoot some hoops. Yeah, he was basically done with the movie at that point because it should have ended there. So it didn't really hold his attention at that point. It was done, even though it was only 80 minutes. And I know I told you this, but Orphan Alley was, like, so bleak. I was like, oh, my God. I think I'd rather go to Bartertown from Mad Max than to Orphan Lane.
That coming from Jess is an insult.
Like, I thought
no other.
Bartertown from Mad Max.
She hated Bartertown.
Rent-free in my head, like, a lot since I watched that movie. And I watched it for the first time for this podcast. And I was like, I thought that Orphan Lane was bleaker than that. I'd rather take my chances with Auntie Tina Turner.
Yeah. And it's just unnecessary at this point.
Yeah, the movie's
the
over.
Like, I don't know why he didn't go there earlier.
He forgets he saves the day. The cats all disappear, apparently. All the cats of the world disappear on a boat to Hong Kong. Yeah, and he goes to freaking dystopia land.
It makes no sense here. Like, I would have taken this scene and plucked it out and put it in where when Fievel escapes from the sweatshop and wanders around New York for a while, drop him in Orphan Alley there and then have him run back into Tony afterwards, which he does anyway. He, you know, wanders New York and runs into Tony. Not knocking the screenwriters too hard. They came, they're like Sesame Street writers.
The only other thing I'd say that I guess I found it kind of funny is that they have the big mouse of Minsk, which is this big scary mouse that like scares all the cats into the ocean. And then they end up on the boat to Hong Kong. And I guess where I get to the messaging of like, okay, well, we got rid of the cats. And, you know, now America's, we could live our American dream now because we put a half a dozen cats from Brooklyn on a boat. It felt kind of like, what's the message here?
America is fixed.
It's fixed.
We fixed America. You're welcome. We will never have class or race or species issues ever again. We fixed
it. It's enough for six-year-olds, though. Like, they're fine with that. Yeah. But as an adult, I was like, I don't know.
Okay. To wrap on the things that I actually genuinely like about this movie, I do love the world building in which there is a secret mouse society going on just beyond all of our viewpoint, where the mice are shadowing everything we're doing. And that's just kind of fun. I like the idea that whatever I go through, there might be a little older sister mouse out in my yard doing the same thing. Although I'm not doing anything that interesting anymore. But
yeah. Amanda's gardening in the suburbs of Boston.
It's theoretically fun. Yeah, she's she's got her own little garden full of beans or whatever.
I mean, there is something nice about that. And I think that that's fun, even as an adult to watch. Like, you know, we have read the Borrower's books in our house, too. So the whole idea of that there's another world of creatures or other things is kind of fun. It still resonates with kids. I'll just say, that piece resonated with my son. It's charming for kids. It's not charming for an adult now watching again, but it still kind of lands for kids. I was actually surprised that it landed with him. He lost his attention span, but for the most part, he was in.
Yeah. I do recall after seeing this movie and then doing our fourth grade lessons on immigration that this did really ease the path for understanding that our families weren't here forever, that they came from other places and there was usually a really bad story involved. And even though this is very specifically this mouse family from Ukraine coming here, that I think it made it easier to understand that they showed up here and there wasn't any help and that people were trying to take advantage of them and that there were bad guys that they didn't know about before they got here. Or just even how they idealized America, that, oh, everything's going to be perfect once we get there. There'll be no cats and the streets are paved with cheese. It's just like, oh, yes, I saw that in American Tail, so now I understand that they thought it would be smooth sailing once they got here. And it was a good entry into some of the immigration stories that we later learned about.
I wondered if it's dated. It's hard to say, and it's hard to watch this movie now with like the political backdrop of things now with immigration, but I don't know, I'm a cranky bitch at this point.
I mean, I think it's still applicable to, you know, just different stories and different cultures. I have friends who immigrated here from Uganda, and they were driven out by violence, and, you know, I think that unfortunately still does apply, that we've got elements of society that resonate this little mouse family's experience.
I mean, maybe. So. Maybe I shouldn't be such a curmudgeon about it. If you just put better songs on this, maybe it could still... Disney, if you're listening, because we like to just pretend that you are.
Disney, can you properly steal this movie instead of just stealing a little of it?
Properly steal it.
Do it with a much better soundtrack, and everybody will gasp and... You know, you'll win an Oscar. It'll be amazing.
That's my pitch. I like that we do a pitch.
I'll quickly say, just in line with things that are great, there's a scene where the mouse have a "we're building something" montage, and that always...
I know you love your montages.
Love them building the great mouse immense.
It was so funny to me. It was like the Fievel has a plan, and it's like, what's the plan? Everyone looks busy. What's happening? Like, everyone immediately gets to work, and I'm like, what are we doing here, guys? I feel left out.
Well, I'm assuming behind the scenes, Gussie got her mice all in line, and that she, because, you know, Fievel's plan was like, let's make a big mouse and scare them. And she was probably like, the boat to Hong Kong leaves at 6 a.m. and if we chase him at this trajectory, yeah.
She's gotten that.
You need a lady to sort that out. Yes, she got it.
Yes. So.
I love when they're chasing the mice out, they're chasing the cats out on this giant contraption they've built, and you see the mice like parachuting out of it to bail at the last second. Like, there's just something really cute and funny about that. You know, little Tanya with her umbrella and the Mouskowitz parents without the baby.
Because I don't know what happened with the baby. Oh, just gone. So dark.
You're not parachuting with the baby. That would be dangerous. Where is the baby?
Not to deflate your bubble here, but I thought it was fun. It resonated with Isaac. He thought it was fun. You know, he like the mayhem is fun. It didn't elicit laughs of joy, of funniness, right? There's no arrow in the butt, like we were saying. There's no Lady Gluck. There's not the slapstick that kids really find funny. Yeah, I feel like I'm being like a real harsh bitch on this movie, but
okay.
Maybe I'm just pro cat as I sit here drinking my beer from my. It's like, let me get out my evil monocle. I sound very pro-cat.
Jess is very, very team cat.
Is it like my Jewish Eastern European heritage winning or my lesbian love of cat winning? It's a hard call, guys.
Well, with all of that in mind, we feel ready to rate.
So just to remind listeners, at this point, we will rate 1 to 10. The scale is 1 is garbage, 10 is Princess Bride. We first rate it for adults, and then we imagine a rating for kids today. We start with adults, 1 to 10. I had to really kind of think about this, but Amanda, what do you think?
I am going to give this probably a 5. I'm landing it right in the middle. It didn't annoy me so much that I want to give it a bad review, and I do love that it was 80 minutes long. Madeline Kahn's jokes were actually funny to me, but yes, the children are terrible singing, the musicals is awful, but it was only 80 minutes, so I didn't feel like I was suffering through it. So I'm giving it exactly in the middle. It's not good, it's not bad, it's a 5.
So this is where I feel like there's a real difference. There's going to be a difference between my kid rating and my adult rating. I know I've been more generous lately with my ratings, but I'm putting my foot down on this one. I'm giving this a 2 for adults. So I'm giving it a point for brevity, and I'm giving it a point for a little bit for nostalgia, and Madeline Kahn, they each get a 0.5. But it's a 2 because it was a little painful for me to watch as an adult, which is different, I think, from a kid's experience.
Wow.
And I know that this is lower than I gave Rudolph, and this is on par with Babes of Toyland for me and Mad Max, where I was just in pain watching this movie again, even at 80 minutes. I was like, this is no good for me. So a 2.
Wow.
I'm pro cat. Right. I guess the lesbian cat owner won out. So that's a 2 for me.
There may be a gay cat in this, and that still doesn't sway you. All right. Yeah, that's a pretty low score from you.
I think
I possibly
like overscored some other things previously, so I'm making up for that, but that's only a 7.
I think you underscored Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, by the way, but because that's your big 2.
But you know what? I probably did underscore that because it lives rent-free in my head and has for a while now.
You're letting Mad Max percolate.
So next rating is kids. So rate same scale, 1 being garbage, 10 being Princess Bride. We imagine what does this live up to kids today? So not necessarily us. And I think this is for younger kids.
Yes. This is definitely a movie for younger kids. Fievel is 7 years old. Your son is probably the perfect target audience. Your daughter, who's a tween, probably not so much.
She would have been pretty bored.
Even though it is a movie that supports how older sisters are the only logical people in the world.
But no one does that better is the Addams Family.
That is true. I'm going to give this, I think, a 6.5 with the consideration that we said this is for 7-year-olds, not 12-year-olds.
Yeah, that's fair.
So I'm going higher than like a Troop Beverly Hills or a
So
Adventures
wrong about
Babysitting,
those movies you were.
But again, for the young for the younger crowd, I'm saying this. And Jess,
I'm not going to be as harsh on this one for kids because it is still enjoyable. It's simple. It's short. The kids get it. For some of these older movies, it is like kind of a big compliment when my son talks to me about it the next day. Like, it clearly resonated. So I'm going to go as high as a 6. This is a little bit above average for kids. You know, for parents out there, it's fine. Put this on for your kids. But good God, you have a drink and sit in the other room. And you're playing this for your kids. But no, kids will like it. It's simple enough. They get enough out of it. I'm realizing now I probably grossly underrated Robin Hood for Kids at this point. What did I give Robin Hood for Kids?
You gave it a 7.5. So it was a whole point higher.
What's our total?
We are at 19.5. That's low. Which we know where the lower scores tend to end up.
Yeah, so this is not...
But we still have one part of this that we need to settle.
Yeah, Amanda's referring to. This isn't the only... It's not just the score. It's whether it lives up or not. And that's a yay or nay from each of us. And it has to be unanimous for it to live up. To make the case for this is that you're right. It sort of helps in the empathy and understanding of immigration. Kids really like it. There's a lot of kids' movies that we've watched on this podcast that really are way too dated for kids. And this is definitely not one of those. So that I guess, is my case for this to live up. You know where I'm going with this.
I'm watching Jess's facial expression. I absolutely can see the look in her eye on where this is going.
Sometimes when you're watching a cartoon, especially something geared towards little kids, and you can get another dimension of appreciation for a movie, that is great and makes it live up. And we've seen that for Muppet Movie and Robin Hood and some of the other geared towards younger kids. There's nothing here for adults, I think. It's like...
I'm watching Jess try so hard to be nice.
I really do. Like I said, like I'd rather sit leather halter top in Bartertown than go to Orphan Lane. Like I think this movie just had no charm in it, and I couldn't get into it. It doesn't live up for me, is what I'm saying.
There it is.
But wait, is it a split decision though? I'm curious. I just tanked it.
So yeah, it. At this point, it does not matter what I say.
I've rendered Amanda's opinion useless. Agree,
and it does not live up because Jess has said it doesn't. I will split this decision because I thought for children of a certain age that this still is entertaining and is a good primer for all the terrible things any given family probably went through to move to America. It's not a great movie. I thought it was a okay-ish movie.
Cool. If you went first, or if I said it lived up, would you still say it lived up?
I would have, yes.
Oh, I should have.
Yep, independent of you. I decided that beforehand.
No, wait,
Siskel and Ebert gave us two thumbs down. Yeah, well, they were right. So you're not alone here. You're not alone here. No, I just, for kids, I think you can still show this to, you know, a seven-year-old audience, and that it is... entertaining to watch. It definitely does have some darker moments, but I think kids are not aware of the rated R movie that's going on with the humans in the background. Whereas I think us adults are looking at this going, oh, this is pretty heavy, but it's not heavy. It's mice who take baths and teacups, and it's like,
now you're making me feel like a real like pro
no,
cat.
You didn't enjoy
asshole.
This for one second. You did not enjoy watching this, so stand by your rating. You hated watching
this. Wasn't as painful as like, I feel really bad now.
If you feel like your ancestors are
judging me for not liking the immigrant story that was told in mouse form. So, but unfortunately, I'm the asshole here. We tanked this one. It did not live up officially because we both need to agree.
She's a cat lady, people. She's
pro-cat.
I'm going to
post my cat koozie. I'm a pro-cat fascist. Anyway, so send all the complaints my way.
You're making more out of this movie.
I feel like
this
I'm really spiraling out here.
There,
and,
so.
But, so, you know. Although I know I don't want to hear from...
She's going to have a complex over an American tale.
Like I want to hear from people who like totally agree with me and think that you're the asshole, Amanda. So, at LiveUpPod.
Sure, go nuts.
Let me know what you think. Do you agree with us? Am I a harsh bitch? Is Amanda too generous? Let us know what you think.
I'm just going to whip around and be like, how dare you condemn these Ukrainian Jewish mice? How dare you?
Oh, and I'm just like, I kind of like the cats. Oh, man.
It's not a literal metaphor. We're all fine. No, you're just a cat lady. That's all. You're just a cat lady.
Be that one out here, people. All right. Yeah.
She's pro-cat.
Thanks for listening. And you know I'm right, folks. Come at me and yell at Amanda.
Thanks for listening.